The hour of recess having expired, the Senate is now in session. Senator from 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Without objection, the Senate will go to the order of business of introduction of special guests.
On the order of business, introduction of guests. Senator from Buchanan, what purpose do you seek recognition?
Mr. President, today we have visiting with us some people from the Platte County Board of Services. For the developmentally disabled, we have Janice Hellman and Teresa Emerson, and they have with them Kara Emerson, whose birthday it is today, and Tom Welliver and Carolyn Strode.
Well, happy birthday, and would the guests of the Senator from Buchanan please rise and the body make them feel welcome. Senator from Johnson, what purpose do you seek recognition?
Thank you very much, Mr. President. I have two very special people here today. They came this morning to have be a part of a conference dealing with BRAC, Base Realignment and Closure Commission, and the importance of supporting our troops and our military installations in the state of Missouri. First of all, the Director of Military and Veteran Services is Charles Lynn Louder, stationed at the University of Central Missouri in Warrensburg. And accompanying him is Delilah Nichols, who is a coordinator of Military and Veteran Services, also at the University of Central Missouri.
Would the body please make the guests of Senator from Johnson feel welcome. On your order of business of introduction of guests, Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Photographers from KOMU-TV have been given permission to take pictures in the Senate chamber today. Mr. President, without objection, the Senate will go to the order of business of Senate bills for perfection, the informal calendar, Senate Bill 842.
Senate bills for perfection, informal calendar, Senate Bill 842. Senator from the 24th.
And Mr. President, Madam Secretary reminded me if we were going to adopt the Senate committee substitute, we're on that motion still.
You need to bring it before the body first.
I move that we bring Senate Bill 842 before the body.
Heard the motion, Senator from 21st. All in favor of that motion say aye. Opposed, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. We're on the motion. The Senator from 24th has moved for the adoption of Senate committee substitute.
I renew my motion.
I haven't asked for that, Senator, yet. The Senator from 24th has moved for the adoption of Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 842. Does any Senator wish to speak on that motion? Senator from the 11th, what purpose do you seek recognition?
May I briefly inquire of the Senator from 24th?
Senator from 24th, do you yield?
Certainly.
He yields. Senator, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator, thanks for yielding. I heard most of the discussion from this morning, so I'm kind of just still familiarizing myself with all the issues. The current contribution system of the 29%, is that like a formula of 14.5% from the district?
Yes, from both sides.
14.5% from the teacher. Okay. And then, now that's in PSRS, and then there's a lower, I assume for non-teachers, right, in the
second system that I think their rate's 11.5%, but we're whatever.
13.72, does that sound right?
Yep.
For the other one?
Yep.
6.86 from each? Okay.
Yeah.
All right, I'm trying to, okay. Now, the funding ratio on PSRS is, what, with your bill, it goes from 77.7% to 85.5%, is that
actually,
right?
that's what when the board adopted these steps, it resulted in the funding ratio on an actuarial basis improving by that amount.
Okay. Now, the other issue I heard you in the bill, I wanted to kind of go over with you, and I want to, okay, so you're setting a basement until, financially you're setting a basement until it's 100% funded, right?
Correct.
Okay. And then within that criteria is you're also setting a COLA at 2%. And could you kind of tell me how that is triggered?
Sure.
Is there a reference to the inflation rate?
Yes. What the board agreed to is that when CPI is below 4.9%, then the COLA would be 2%. COLA would be above 5%, regardless of how high above 5% would be. The COLA would be set at 5%.
Okay. What the one of the arguments against this that you talked about this morning was this whole concept of flexibility.
Right.
What happens in the next 30 years, for example, next 5 years, next 36 months, if the inflation trigger of the 2% COLA is off that percentile? What happens under your bill?
If it were to move from 2 to 5, that's what your question is?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, what would
happen if we have a 7% inflation rate?
And anything that would cause the inflation rate to go from the COLA to go from 2 to 5 would make the plan be actuarially less sound. Because again, you're promising that COLA to the both the existing beneficiaries as well as future beneficiaries, but it's the existing beneficiaries that would then get a 5% COLA if that trigger were to occur. And were that to occur, then in fact the actual soundness, the funding ratio would go down.
Okay. So kind of go over it by putting this in statute.
Yep.
The board of these retirement systems met and came up with this. Okay?
Yes.
And in theory, they would be able to adjust it, right? But now by putting it in statute, what if there's a need or adjustment somewhere in the next, year to 30 years?
Right.
How does all that work?
Right. Well, let's assume that they put this in place with the purpose of making sure that the plan is sound, that they're the goal of getting to 100% funded. Because not until you're 100% funded are you actuarially sound. So what could occur is that the actual performance of the plan in the next 5 years as a time, let's say that the plan performance is extraordinary, that it's 25% for 5 years, and we have an extraordinary period of growth with little inflation, and the COLA stays at 2%, and the plan gets to 100% funded, at which point they now have total discretion. They can decide what COLA they want to use, they can decide what contribution rate they want to lose. That's the trigger. What we heard was the board wanted the flexibility, and I guess my question was, for what? So what is implied, because what we've done is we've outlined a path where, don't decrease the contribution below 14.5 until you get to be 100% actuarially sound. So in the committee substitute, we said, well, maybe you have to increase that. The history of the plan is that they're constantly increasing the contribution. I would say it's just kind of inherent in the fact that these plans don't work as outlined. They always require higher contributions. But if we had a situation where the performance of the investments wasn't 8% the next 5 years, but let's say the performance of the investments was 0 for the next 5 years, they might feel fit that they need to now, at that point, increase the contribution rate, which, as you probably are aware, is they only have the ability to increase the total contribution by 1%. That's by statute. But we gave them that flexibility in the committee substitute. We previously disclosed it. So now, basically, there's a path by which they have flexibility if they need to change their determination to the extent that they're unable to get to 100% funded. They now have some of the tools that they would need to get there. And again, hopefully what happens is they get to 100% funded as fast as possible. And that's what we agreed to adopt their proposal. I would actually be a proponent for having it be 125% funded, because if you heard this morning's conversation, that's what's required. If you get 125% funded of a pension plan, it could withstand a 30% decline in the stock market. So, we hear a lot of gnashing of teeth past 10 years because of how bad the actual performance. Most of these plans' actual performance is in the neighborhood of 3 to 4%. So they've dramatically underperformed their assumed rate of returns. And we hear a lot of issues with that. Had all of those pension plans gotten to 120 or 130% of the actuarially funded ratio, they could have withstood what happened. And it's not crazy that what happened. It happens every, 20 or 30 years. It's very difficult politically to let a plan go beyond 100% funding. When that tends to occur, you have a general, either you're going to, people will petition a plan to either increase the benefit or decrease the contribution. And that's what occurred to this plan and what occurred to most plans.
Senator, would the the system you created in Senate Bill 842 preclude them from going to 125%?
But it does. It gives them discretion to decide what they want to do at 100%. So my hope would be is that this generation of, you know, it's funny, a lot of times what happens with, you know, I like Mark Twain's quote, history doesn't repeat, but it echoes. But one of the greatest dangers in the investment world is that people just don't live long enough to go through the cycles. So now we've had a period where we've had 10 years where everybody that's responsible for pensions, the pension systems like this, they have now actually experienced 10 years of super subpar growth. And you would hope that they would take that institutional knowledge and when given the opportunity once again to allow a plan to go beyond 100% funded, that they actually remember what happened these last 10 years and allow that plan to go well beyond 100% funded. My guess is, unfortunately, though, that the people in charge of pension plans, once they get out of the hole that they found themselves in, they'll probably want to retire. And it'll be some other new generation managers that will forget that this can happen and keep the pension from going beyond 100%.
Okay. And is there a disadvantage in any way of putting this in statute? I mean, what happens if we don't put this in statute?
But what it does is it adds. First of all, by putting in statute, we as elected officials are doing the opposite of what often has happened in the past with respect to pensions, which is we're willing to invest a little of our political capital in something that's easy to vilify and hard to, you know, construe as a positive thing. I can increase my level of certainty that all the people that are beneficiaries today and future beneficiaries will have the pension that they plan their lives around. So by putting it in statute, I can walk out of here, you can walk out of here, and know that if they follow those guidelines with that flexibility, that plan has the best chance of being there for the recipients.
And what I wanted to get at was, I mean, again, I heard the discussion this morning. Would they do this plan absent Senate Bill 842?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question.
Would the board do this? I mean,
there's no certainty to that. I mean, again, they have complete discretion today.
All they did this summer that you're referring to was they just proposed it.
They adopted it. They adopted it, and okay. You could have a turnover in the board. I mean, my concern would be is that the plan go back to maybe where start of the decade. I think it was about 96% funded. That they hold the hard line, they stick with their adopted plan. They get to 96% funded, and they say this is close enough. I mean, one of the great myths in the pension world is the idea that a plan that's 80% funded is fine. My concern would be is that a plan that gets towards 100% funded, that somewhere along the way that board changes, maybe our body changes, and we see them decide to either reduce the contribution rate, to expand the COLA. That would be my concern. They change the parameters by which people actually get to retire earlier. My hope is with this legislation, the plan has the best chance to get into 100% funded. Like I mentioned before, I just assume it'd go beyond that, but I think I'm willing in this legislation to just match what the positions that were put forward by the board.
Thank you for the inquiry, Senator.
Senator from St. Francis, what purpose do you seek recognition?
To inquire the senator from the 24th.
Senator from the 24th, do you yield? You yield, Senator, you may proceed.
Senator, I appreciate you making the changes that I asked the committee to go ahead and give them the flexibility if they do need to raise the and they're going to need to raise the rate. They came to this body about 10 years ago and said, if we've got so much money, we've got over $1 billion, over 100% funded, we'll never have to raise the rate again. We can change it from 5-year average to 3-year average. In other words, a teacher's best 3 years rather than their best 5 years. We're going to give them bonuses if they stay longer. We're going to do these things to make the pension plan so much better. And everybody testified, everybody except one person from NHTSA, testified that this was going to be the best thing ever, and it would make them solidify this, plus have a better benefit to all their participants. And you know that.
Yes,
but
Senator,
I don't think you go far enough here, and what I'm standing up today to talk to you is hopefully next year you'll still be in this body, and I'll be in the body across the building. And what I'm telling you, we have been vilified because we've been put in this position that we want these people's money, and we want their pension plan. Well, you know, we have rebounded from the depth because the market has, two things have happened, as you're very much aware of. The bond market has went up. It started down again the last couple months, but it went up last year. The stock market went up during that period, and we've had a good first quarter. So we're no longer at $6 billion in debt. We're $5 billion under. And as I said in committee, I don't know about you, but I wake up at night hoping that I can steal $5 billion in debt. That's what I want, is the $5 billion in debt. I don't have enough debt on my house. I don't have enough debt in this state. I want $5 billion more debt from this pension plan. We've got to have it. I don't know how we can. We are so smart that we're going to steal their debt.
Yeah.
And I know the senator from Cape has been accused of wanting to do their legal work. That's why he wants to do this. And you and I have been, we're going to manage the money. I know I have. I've lost a couple clients over this because we have been so cruel. I cannot understand a group that doesn't want their pension plan protected. Now, you didn't talk really much about this morning how this group represents hundreds of thousands of people and families in the state, and that they don't have Social Security. If this thing does not stay viable, if it does not stay funded, they can't rely upon their Social Security. Is that not correct?
Well, of course that's true, Senator. I actually think that much as them not getting the benefit would be that the rest of the state would have to bear the burden. You know, what happened in our state at the end of 1982 through 1999 was one of those extraordinary periods of time where the total return of all these pensions funds were, you know, once in a 100-year period of time. And you know, I'm grateful for the fact that, you know, we made some of the mistakes as a state in terms of expanding the benefits and increasing the eligibility, all that kind of stuff.
That's a good point. Did you know that when they made these changes, they came, because I saw it in writing, they came to that committee and they used that highest 10-year period ever.
Yep.
And extrapolated that the pension plan would go on like that forever. Now, I don't know if you know this, but when you extrapolate like this, I don't know if you've ever heard this, but in 1970, one in 10 million people in America made their living as an Elvis impersonator. And in 1980, 1 in 1 million people made their living as an Elvis impersonator. And in 1990, 1 in 100,000 people made their living as an Elvis impersonator. And in 2000, 1 in 10,000 people made their living as an Elvis impersonator. So if you extrapolate like that, in the year 2020, 1 in 10 people will make their full-time living as an Elvis impersonator. You can't do that. You can't take the best 10 years ever and use that to say we'll never go down from
here. I mean, so the entire country thought by the end of 1999 that good times were going to happen forever. But you know, I'd say to beneficiaries and people in this plan now, I don't think this has necessarily been truly represented to them, the fact that this is so very difficult to actually provide for a pension. I look at, you know, this plan that we're talking about started in 1946. It was a 3% employee contribution. It was doubled in 57. By 1986, it was up to 9.5%. It's gone up, you know, every 7 or 8 year period. Obviously, we're now up to 14.5%. So for people that are in these plans,
14.5% for both sides.
For both sides. In every case, the point is to say is that, it, you know, if you think as somebody who's participating in this plan as an employee or a beneficiary, recipient of the pensions, you've got to recognize that something's just not right, that this is such a very difficult thing to do, that it's going to require continuous overtime, more and more contributions.
Right. At the same time, from the start of this plan, the average teacher spent twice the amount of time working in the classroom as they did in retirement. Now, they spend more time during their retirement years because of the length of the longevity than they do working. So that payout period for this plan has become longer and longer at the same time their rates are going up.
Yeah, so, yeah. It's like, Senator, there's 120,000 people that are either participating or as beneficiaries of this plan today, and I'm of the opinion that the state, we're obligated to those 120,000 people. And what the Senator from Cape discussed this morning, which is unfortunate, is that this system is one of the, you know, they have the idea of creating a new tier, next generation of employees, they fight against that idea, and I think that if they're, you know, we've had this thing since 1946, we've had great, wonderful markets. That's after World War II, so incredible periods of economic growth, periods of recession, and at the end of all this period of time, it's $5 billion underfunded. And so the idea of to say, well, let's have the next 50 years or 60 years of teachers be in the same type of plan, I don't understand that thought, and I think the best service that they could do to their pensioners is to create a new class. You know, it's extraordinary. We, on the scale of things, we hear a lot from these groups that, well, our plan's one of the better plans. Our plan's number four in the country. Yeah. And, you know, that's fine. That, you know, that I'm glad we're number four in the country. Unlike, you know, Illinois and Rhode Island and California and New York, where people that are actually recipients are seeing their benefits cut. I mean, I have no idea how Illinois comes out of this whole, the $65 billion underfunded hole, not to mention the fact that they actually issued debt to make whatever contributions they made. So,
this
is not reform. What we're trying to do is not reform. It is just, hey,
I want to point out, we need reform. Now, the powers that be have come to me privately and say, we all know we need reform, but let's wait until the senator from Cape is gone because he'll make it into a defined contribution plan, and we don't want to make the changes. We don't want to stop the administrators and superintendents retired from double dipping, from go ahead and at 52 or 53 years old, even though they didn't put near as much in actuarially to be able to come up with it, be able to take their full retirement and then come back and work as a consultant to the school district so that they can go ahead and take money out of the retirement plan while they're double dipping. We're not changing any of that.
Right.
The board doesn't want to change any of that because the reason I was given by two people in this building that's heavily involved with this industry is they said, we don't want to change it while the senator from Cape's there because he'll take over your bill and it will be turned into a defined contribution plan. But I'm telling you, Senator, we're trying to protect these people's retirement. I don't want to do this and force the board, but if the board is going to make these claims and they're going to say, well, we're going to make 8% for the next 30 years, when, 20-30% is in bonds at the average 30-year treasury rate right now at what?
3% rising.
3%, so the other part of the equities has to make 12-14% for the next 30 years. Do you know what any mutual fund that has made 12-14% for a 30-year period of time?
Just my personal one.
Just yours? Yeah, well, we'd like to...
How do we buy it?
I said, what's the load on that?
Let me suggest this, and I appreciate the yeoman's work Senator from Cape has done in his time in the Senate, and he's made great strides. I think that, in particular, the new class that he's introduced for other government state employees is a great step. As much as one might come to think that will be my focus these next 2 years, in this whole process, I've come to understand there's actually another liability that's out there, and with so many of these plans, the government plans, where we offer pension and we try to fund the pension. We also offer health care, in some cases it bridges a gap between retirement and where Medicare starts. And I learned in this whole process that FASB, the Accounting Standards Board, about 10 years ago came out with a ruling that basically said, look, this is an unfunded liability, and that we encourage entities, government entities, to begin the process of setting up a trust fund to fund the cost of this health care, this gap. And I think the acronym is something like other pension benefits. I think it's OPEB, whatever that encompasses. And what's interesting, nationwide, it's estimated that the unfunded pension gap is about $1 trillion. Big number. The unfunded health care is $2 trillion. And there's not one state in the union that has set aside $1 in a trust to fund that liability. So as much as some might think that, you know, given my background, that this would be something that I'll focus on, and again, this is not reform. This is just codifying a very wise choice on behalf of this board. I might be inclined to come back and consider other things that one could consider reform, but I'm going to start to dig deeper and better understand. I think Missouri should be the first state, apparently, no other state that's taken this up, the first state to really measure the liability and begin the process of setting aside the proceeds necessary, because what we're doing now is we're just pay as you go.
Well, you're right, but you're walking through a minefield. Because if you get, I'm sure you've got emails, this group, like a lot of groups, believes whatever their leadership tells them. Very similar to the federal government. You can't touch Medicaid because the Republicans want to starve you to death.
Yeah.
You can't touch Medicare. You can't touch Social Security, even though everybody knows the math doesn't work. As long as you scare your participants,
Actually, I think we heard yesterday that what we are for is social Darwinism, which implies that we're for, you know, killing off the meek and the poor. Yeah. No, I'm sure
if you say it in college words, Harvard words,
yeah,
it's not as offensive if you say you're for social Darwinism instead of the Republicans are for
letting
people die. No, so it's nicer. If he said it in Latin, he would have even said pretty. Sounded pretty.
There's a lot of misinformation. I mean, you probably got the same, email, the kind of form email that suggests that the Senate Bill 842 will freeze the COLA for 2% for 30 years, which, of course, is not true, actually, that once the fund is 100% funded, then the COLA can float. And if inflation is higher than 5%, then it will be 5%. So,
but if you tell these people this and you instill fear in it because that's their only retirement plan, they don't care if your math makes sense. They just don't want you to do anything.
Yeah, but this is the
conversation. And they've convinced them that $5 billion underfunded is a good thing.
Yeah, well,
look at everybody else. It's not bad. $5 billion's good. It's good. We got the best plan around. We're only $5 billion in debt. We can't make our obligations. $5 billion. What's $5? $5 billion's good. Our friends are $6 billion. It's like having kids. Well, Dad, you should have seen Billy. You think I was stupid? Billy was really stupid. Does that make your kids' action any better? Because Billy was really stupid, Dad.
I don't listen to my children. That's a success. I have six children. I don't listen to what they have to say. They listen to me.
Well, I don't like doing what we're going to do. I'm going to vote for it. But it doesn't solve the problem. When I'm asking you, when maybe some of these people that are so scared of the senator from Cape, next year, call at the other end of the building. If I answer the phone, I may be down there. Let's start talking about changing it so superintendents can't double dip. That we go back to the 5-year total average. That we show some sense of money in and money out. We have a situation in my area, which is fine. I don't blame the guy at all because it's within the rules. He goes someplace else and rents an apartment to a bigger school district and gets 3 years of top pay for principal, $150,000 a year, but he didn't actuarially ever put in enough money when he was teaching the first 15 years to pay out what he's going to pay out now at 52 years old.
He's just following the law. You know, people make the law, people make the tax code, you comply with the law, you comply with the tax code.
So he didn't break the law. I would have done the same thing.
I don't vilify anybody for following the law. I mean, you know, shame on us because we set the rules.
Shame on us because we set out the bad rules. We had the discussion, I know the senator from Cape hates this, but a few years ago we had the developmentally disabled. They were doing some things that completely were wrong, but they were following our rules. That's a problem. And when we set parameters up in these systems, and that's what I'm asking you to do next year, let's look at some parameters that will keep the viability of the teacher's pension plan safe for long-term future so that we don't have to worry about 8% return on all the money to keep it viable, that we should be viable with just the contributions and a little bit more. And if we do have a period of time where the market goes to 25,000 on the Dow, all the better. We get up to 125% funding. Right. but we don't rely upon that for the fundamental structural that we have in this retirement plan that is wrong right now. We're going to have to change that. This bill does not change it. I think it holds the feet of that pension board to the fire, but next year I'm asking you to work with me to try to do the not. Now, you may want to go completely to start a different thing. That I don't think that's going to be political viable, but we can at least do some of the things, structural changes that are wrong, and at least get a start on it and start making people more and more aware that if we don't do something, their future without Social Security and without a stable pension could be in jeopardy.
Okay.
Thank you.
We're on the motion of the senator from the 24th. Does any other senator wish to speak on that motion? Senator from Andrew, what purpose do you seek recognition?
I'd like to inquire the senator from Cape.
Senator from Cape, you yield. Senator from Andrew. He yields. Senator, you may proceed.
Thanks, Senator. I want to go through just a couple things. I mean, I know you spend a tremendous amount of time working on all this retirement stuff, and I just want to walk through, for my knowledge, and then I'll inquire the senator from the 24th. Full disclosure, I mean, as you know or may know, I have a mom who's a teacher. She gets these emails of, you know, do not let these horrible things happen to our pension plans, and those get forwarded on to me.
Fact of the matter is
not
that my mom's a teacher, my brother's a teacher, my grandmother's a teacher, and they're all in this same retirement system.
Right. So they're getting the same
email. And I have a little brother that can beat me up, if you haven't heard that.
I've heard that. I can still outrun my little brother, so I'm not sure if he can beat me up.
Your little brother's not little, though.
That's a good point. Okay, we essentially have four different retirement plans in this state. We have the PSRS, Mosiers, Emperors, and Loggers.
I guess it's That's interesting right. how you want to define we have and what retirement systems are. Like St. Louis Police and Fire, they're in state statute as well.
Okay.
Kansas City teachers, St. Louis teachers, they've got statutes as well. What are commonly referred to as state retirement systems, you're exactly right. But in the interest of disclosure,
okay.
There's a whole lot of retirement systems.
And right now, PSRS is funded at what percentage? What is the current?
Right now, because they adopted this stabilization policy
right.
that this legislation seeks to put in policy, according to their latest actuarial, they are at 85.5%.
Okay, and to clarify, I think my understanding is that what you, I think, just articulated, what the Center from the 24th is doing is taking current board policy and implementing it in statute.
Right.
So everything that we're talking about here on the floor, they've already adopted.
They already adopted with everyone's endorsement. When I say everyone's endorsement, the special interest groups that follow
these
things.
And not the email saying don't let them.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't do that when the board was adopting this policy. And remember, this funding stabilization policy only works if you do it for the actuarial length that you said you were going to do it, 30 years. It doesn't get you to 85.5% funding unless you follow it for that period of time. You don't magically, and this is what we said earlier, prior to the adoption of the funding stabilization policy, PSRS was at 77.7% funded ratio. For the preceding 7 years, every single year, they did not meet their ARC, their actuarially required contribution rate, by in excess of $100 million. Now, that's not their fault. We have a cap that when then-representative, now our senator from the 23rd, passed that said PSRS's ARC, 0.5% from the employer and 0.5% from the teacher, is the most that it can ever be raised in any given year.
Right.
So that's caused funding issues. During that same time period, we also passed just over almost $4 billion in new benefit enhancements over that period of time. And we've discussed those benefit enhancements. We're not changing those benefit enhancements.
Now, as for Mosiers, for the rest of these retirement funds, where are they funded at? Are they in the 80s as well, or are they not?
No. The worst is Emperors, and we've discussed Emperors at length.
Is Emperor's below 40%? Where's it's below 40% funded, but Emperor's is taking its steps to fix that as well. We passed a new tier for Emperor's during the special session.
Right.
Employees are now making a 4% contribution rate they never did before. 80 and out is gone. It's now 90 and out.
Right.
Minimum retirement age, vesting periods. So that's going to help as new hires come in and old hires come out, because actuarially their plan is not as expensive as it used to be. Remember when I was talking with the senator from the 24th, you have two ways in which to deal this. You can make your plan cheaper, or you can do a stabilization policy, but you have to follow that stabilization policy, just like you have to follow the new tier policy.
And
so, but the main reason they're not funded is because during the Ashcroft administration, in particular, Governor Ashcroft decided that he wanted to build roads as opposed to fund employee pension liabilities. So they went a number of years with no contributions to their employment retirement system, and that threw them all out of whack, and now they're playing catch-up, which, to Emperor's credit, they are doing now. Last year, and I think they will again this year, they did $5 million above and beyond their ARC, their actuarially required rate. They agreed to a new tier. They're taking proactive steps, but yeah, they're in serious trouble.
How about Mosier's?
I don't know what the latest was on Mosier's. I'm looking to Rhonda there. Is Mosier's, I think she's...
Help me, Rob.
She's sending me a email.
Good.
And that email is coming in at this point.
I'd call that snail mail.
Yeah, snail mail. Mosier's is at 79%. Loggers is at 82%. PSRS, we've talked about. And Emperor's is at 43%.
What was Mosier's?
Mosier's is at 79%.
Okay. So now, have all of these funds, Senator, taken the appropriate steps to start moving themselves?
We created a new tier with Mosier's.
Great.
We created a new tier with Emperor's.
Right. That was last year in the special.
Well, the special session with the four. Not Aerotropolis special session, Ford special session. Well, and I'll tell you that the very worst system is judges, but we are taking steps to pay for the judges. We rejected one step. I wanted to move forward, but judges are 25% funded. Almost as a pay-as-you-go retirement system.
That is... and they're their own? Are they a subset of something?
They're a subset of Mosier's.
Okay.
But they are their own benefit package. Like I said, when we talk about Mosier's, when we had my bill out on the floor, and I wanted to consolidate all of the different Mosier's benefit packages into one, within Mosier's you have what I'll call the average state worker, the regular state worker. You have General Assembly members like you and I. You have statewide office holders like you are hoping to become.
Right.
And then you have the judiciary. And I wanted to take all of those into one system. What we were able to do is we kept the judges by themselves, and everyone else in that bill went to the regular state worker. So we went from 4 to 2.
Right.
And that was a cost savings, but also a fairness issue and changes, you know.
So we are in the 70s and 80s with three of our four. We're in the 40s with one. Now, if I understand correctly, and I'm by no means an expert on this, part of what PSRS has done, or part of their plan, is they do it in a closed amortization. Is that right? Is that how?
Part of what they object to, and I didn't have this conversation, but the senator from the 24th relayed to me, is the fact that they didn't want a time period on anything. Meaning,
didn't want one.
Yeah, they could reset at any time, so it didn't matter. What we're saying is you have to have a closed 30-year amortization period, because if you never, ever capture a time period, then it doesn't even matter what your assumptions are. You just restart the first every year. So it doesn't mean anything.
Okay, so and are we doing that with everyone? Is it, do we have the same?
All of these are amortized to a 30-year actuarial certainty.
Okay, and so all four of these are in the same closed. Okay, so I mean, what we're asking them to do is no different than what we've done with Mosiers or Emperors.
All we're asking them to do is what they say they're already doing. Okay, that's so all this bill does.
So, Senator, the argument, what is their argument against this? Why is it that they are, why is it that my mom is getting the email she gets? Why are they working the halls trying to end this up?
You know, I don't want to put words in their mouths. If you haven't figured out why they oppose it by now, you're probably not, because I can't. Other than, you know, I can give you my belief of what's going on. They don't want a new tier. They don't want to address this problem, and they don't have any intention of following the funding stabilization plan that they said they were going to follow.
So in order for these other groups to come back and change their plans, are their plans codified in statute as well?
The benefit changes are. That's why we had to pass those statutes.
Okay. So all that is happening today with PSRS is we are treating them the same we treated everyone else.
Well, no, because we haven't reduced the benefit packages. We're actually treating them better.
Okay.
They're not taking a cut in their retirement benefits for future hires at all.
Okay.
They're getting the same rich benefit package that I explained that between 1995 and 2007 resulted in $3.8 billion in new actuarial liabilities and enhancement benefits. We're not changing one of those. They get all of their new benefits. So if I was going to characterize it, what we are doing here is all the other funds, we had changes to tiers, benefit packages, how much retirement costs. Here, PSRS said, we don't want to change or create a new tier. We don't want to change the cost of our fund. But what we will do is we'll make some actuarial assumption changes. And if we follow those actuarial assumption changes for 30 years, it will fix our unfunded liability. As I said, the biggest cost driver is their assurance that for the next 30 years, they will not issue a COLA if above 2% unless CPI is inflation is over 5%. So when you look at the way they used to grant COLAs and factor that in, and now they tell their actuaries, we're not going to do that anymore, that's where you're able, from just the adoption of the new terminology and the actuarial assumptions, you're able to realize a 7% funded ratio increase overnight. By just the adoption of the funding policy, PSRS's own actuary went from saying that they're at 77.7% funded to now 85.5% funded. But it only works if you follow it for 30 years.
Right.
So just like our tiers and the savings associated with the creation of the new Mosiers and Emperors tiers, they only work if you follow them.
Right.
If you come back and change it, it doesn't work. So just like we codified the new tiers, all we're now doing with the senator from the 24th bill is codifying the new scoring methodology. The whole reason I do all of this, Senator, and have buried myself into all of this stuff to raise the attention to the Senate, it is very important, in my opinion, for policymakers that we understand what the true net costs are for all of these systems, that they're not masked in actuarial assumptions, that it's not fuzzy math, that it's not complicated math, that when we are given public policy choices of do you want to vote for this or do you want to vote for that, that we have as clear a picture as possible what the true costs and ramifications are for that vote.
The thing that I find most interesting about this, and, you know, I know in Mosiers there's a little, the employees now put 4% in, and Emperors and Loggers, are those Do the employees contribute to those, or are those still?
Well, there's a difference. Right now, PSRS is funded by half a contribution rate from the districts and half a contribution rate from the teachers.
Right.
But they are exempt from Social Security, so they don't have Social Security tax taken out of their paycheck either. Now, I often hear, and I have this conversation with my mom all the time, my brother, they all say, it's not fair I don't get Social Security, and then you say, well, do you want Social Security withholdings? Well, no, I don't want Social Security withholdings. So, you know, they don't have to pay the Social Security tax, but they don't get Social Security either. So you take, what is it, 14.5% of pay for the district, 14.5% pay for the teacher. The contribution rate to fund PSRS now is 29% of pay. Moser's, until we created the new tier, used to be 100% funded by the taxpayers. The employee didn't make a contribution. Now, the Moser's employee makes a 4% contribution in the new tier towards their pay. Loggers is all done on the local level.
Right.
And Loggers has different benefit packages that cities can get into. Some cities choose rich, some cities use cheaper, but it's all done on a local level of where they want to opt in or opt out of.
And Emperor's?
Emperor's is the same as Moser's. Okay. So now they make a 4% contribution rate where it used to be 100%.
Here's why I ask. Is part of the discussion the Center for the 24th and the Center from St. Francis was having earlier, the Center from St. Francis was articulating this idea of going in a different direction. And the thing that I find fascinating is everyone is so concerned about a defined contribution plan. Well, I don't know too many people that put 29% of their pay away every year. And, you know, I mean, what you're really talking about is if this thing was ever funded, and then all of the new employees were actually putting their own money, 14.5 and 14.5, into a defined contribution, they would be some of the highest contributors.
Well, with all due respect, Senator, when you add in what's withheld out of your paycheck from the employer and the employee side of Social Security, you're starting to get into that neighborhood.
No, I know.
Now remember, I mean, we need to do apples to apples and oranges to oranges.
I also don't believe I'm ever getting that back. Like, I mean, I don't think that by the time that you and I get to that point.
Well, I would agree. I would love to not have to pay Social Security.
Right.
And I would love to not be in that system and not have to pay that, because I'm self-employed. I pay the employer side, I pay the employee side, and I don't think I'm getting any of that stuff back. Probably because I'm going to die before I invest.
Right. The
and to remember, that was FDR's big hustle, President Roosevelt's big hustle to everyone when he created Social Security. What did he do? He asked his actuary, what's the life expectancy? And then he added 3 years.
Right.
And said, see, I'm the greatest president ever. I gave you Social Security. But he knew everyone was going to die when they were going to get it. And then we didn't adjust it. And 50 years later, we can't afford it.
Okay, Senator, only one or two more questions. And that is, so all of these, when we're benchmarking these, we benchmark them over 30 years. And we are assuming what return for the 30 years?
Different plans do different assumptions. And what I will tell you is a lot of people get caught up in what is the assumed rate of return. I wouldn't do that. I would focus on the spread. And when I talk about the spread, what I'm talking about is the net of your assumed rate of return to the assumed rate of inflation.
Okay?
So that gets to the spread. And as I discussed earlier, many plans go through 5-year evaluations and they change all of that. I will be the first one to admit that PSRS's spread is lower than, say, a Moser spread.
Okay.
But I'm working on that, and I can tell you if I have anything to do with it, the assumptions that Moser's makes and its spread on its assumed net return on assets is going to go down from the 8.5% that it currently has, probably somewhere into around 6.25, where we get the spread anywhere from 6.25 to 7.25.
And PSRS uses what spread?
I don't know their net spread. I think their assumed rate of return is 8. Their net spread is 6. So PSRS's net spread would be bigger than Moser's right now. So that's what I would be focused on. So I don't have those numbers. I can ask Rhonda what the net spread is on each of the plans, and maybe we could dig that out.
The reason I bring it up is the easy way to, I mean, if you're just trying to look at over a 30-year period, the easy way to change your numbers is adjust your interest rate.
That's the whole point we've been saying behind all of this stuff. What is so important with us changing things, and why I prefer to do a tier, but I can't get the General Assembly and PSRS and them aren't interested in crafting a new tier. So if you can't control your cost, that's the easiest way to deal with everything. Control your cost, your benefit package. But if you want to keep this incredibly rich benefit package, then what we are doing now by moving the senator from the 24th legislation forward is we're going to codify the expensing of that and how expensive that is, so that we do have an understanding of what the true nature of the cost is, and these games can't be played.
Right. Okay.
Which have been historically.
Right. All right, Senator, you answered my questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it, Mr. President.
Senator from Andrew.
I'd like to inquire the Senator from the 24th.
Senator from the 24th, you yield.
I do.
He yields, Senator. You may proceed.
Thanks. Senator, you deal with this type of business every day, and the Senator from St. Francis does the same. I mean, you can stand here and in good conscience say that what we are doing today is beginning to rectify this problem, assuming they stay the course. And by passing your bill, we're essentially ensuring they stay the course.
Well, yeah, we're mandated that they stay the course. I think it's a step in just that. And I'm hopeful that with no other actions, the plan becomes fully funded in 8 or 10 or.
And then at that point, they have more.
Oh, the legislation it triggers is 100% funded. They get all their discretion to do whatever they want to do back.
Okay.
I think that it's a very, very small step, and I think the lack. It's not reality to think that the idea of not introducing a new tier is a mistake on the part of this plan. But that's the decision they've made, and as the Senator described, we don't have the will. Force that new tier. So
now, can they still could they still create a new tier?
I think for this legislative session they'd have to amend it on. But I think my door would be wide open the minute they want to think about creating a new tier. I'll help them craft that.
And then, as for Moser, as for the rest of them, everything other than PSRS, we are benchmarking them the same. We are, I mean, as we have created these structures. Whether it's the language we passed 2 years ago, I mean, I guess my point is we're not treating PSRS any differently other than the tiers. We're not forcing new tiers, but we're not.
Well, absolutely not. No, we're not forcing new tiers, and we're not changing any of the benefits. And the other plans, you know, either by the Senator from Cape's assertion or by on their own regard, have created new tiers.
Okay. Senator, you answered my questions. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. President.
We're on a motion of the Senator from the 24th. Does any other Senator wish to speak on that motion? Seeing none, Senator, you're recognized to close.
So I close on the adoption of the Senate Committee
Senator
substitute.
From the 24th, move that the Senate Committee substitute for Senate Bill 842 be adopted. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Senator from 24th, you're recognized for the perfection motion.
President, I now move that Senate Committee substitute for Senate Bill 842 as amended by the Senate be declared perfected and order printed.
You've heard the motion of the Senator from 24th. Does any Senator wish to speak on that motion? Seeing none, Senator, you're recognized to close.
Close.
Senator from 24th has moved that Senate Bill 842 as amended by the Senate Committee substitute be declared perfected and order printed. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The bill is declared perfected and ordered printed. Senator from the 23rd. What's that? Senator from Lawrence, what purpose do you seek recognition?
Mr. President, are we going to stay on the same calendar? Could we go to the formal calendar, please?
The Senate will be on the order of business of Senate bill's perfection, formal calendar, Senate Bill 837.
Mr. President, I ask that bill be laid on the informal calendar.
It will be laid on the informal calendar. Senate Bill 451. Senate Bill 451, Senator from the 7th. Sergeant at Arms, could you summons the Senator from the 7th? Senate Bill 451, Senator from the 7th.
Thank you, Mr. President. Would you lay that on the informal calendar, please?
It will be laid on the informal calendar. Senate Bill 813, Senator from Newton.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move the Senate Bill 813 be taken up for perfection.
Heard the motion of the Senator from Newton. All in favor of that motion say aye. Opposed, no. The aye appears to have it. The aye does have it. Senator from Newton.
Mr. President, I now move the Senate Bill 813 be declared perfected and printed.
Senator, would you like to explain that?
Thank you, Mr. President. Senate Bill 813 deals with CDARS, C-D-A-R-S, which stands for Certificate of Deposit Registry Service. CDARS is a program that matches funds placed in a local bank with other participating banks, so the entire amount in the bank has full FDI insurance. In 2004, the legislature passed a bill allowing Missouri banks to use CDARS to get additional FDIC insurance over and above the current limits, but it only affected certificates of deposits for political subdivisions. So if a political subdivision had $450,000 in CDs in a bank, the bank could use CDARS to make sure that the entire amount was FDIC insured. The political subdivision did not have to put $250,000 in one bank and the rest in another bank. We'd like to expand this concept to include checking accounts as well as certificates of deposit. The change made in this bill is to change certificates of deposits to deposit accounts. This would allow a local political subdivision to have money in an interest-bearing money market account or a checking account and still have full FDIC full coverage. And with that, Mr. President, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Senator from Newton has moved that Senate Bill 813 be declared perfected and ordered printed. Does any senator wish to speak on that motion? Seeing none, Senator, you recognize to close.
I close.
Senator from Newton has moved that Senate Bill 813 be declared perfected and ordered printed. All in favor of that motion say aye. Opposed, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Senate Bill 813 is declared perfected and ordered printed. Senate Bill 911. Senator from Clay. Senate Bill 911, Senator from Clay. Sergeant at Arms, would you seek the Senator from Clay? Got to get him up here. Senator from Clay, Senate Bill 911.
Yes, Mr. President, I ask that Senate Bill 911 be brought before the body.
Heard the motion from Senator from Clay. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Senator from Clay.
Yes, Mr. President, I now ask that Senate Bill 911 be declared printed, perfected and ordered printed. Mr. President, what Senate Bill 911 does is some time ago we made some changes with regard to our identity theft laws and how Social Security numbers could be used. We prevented the entire Social Security number from being used as an employee identification number for employment-related activity. And what we failed to do at the time was realize that some employers may then switch it over to requiring only the last four digits of the Social Security number. Well, the problem of it is, if somebody has your name and the last four digits of your Social Security number, they may well have your entire identity. Even the Social Security Administration, when they reference the ways to protect your identity and against identity theft, their own OnGuard online.gov from the Federal Trade Commission indicates that you should never use the last four digits of your Social Security number as an identifier or a password. Unfortunately, we have instances in the state of Missouri where it's being required, even though the full disclosure is not required. But if an identity theft knows where you're born, they can pretty much figure out the first three digits of your Social Security number, and then by a process of elimination, they have your entire number. So we are modifying this with this bill. Unless there are any questions, I would renew my perfection motion.
You've heard the motion from the Senator from Clay, Senate Bill 911.
It's brought before the body for perfection. Does any other senator wish to be heard on that motion? The Senator from St. Francis.
Thank you, Mr. President. Dequire, sponsor.
Senator from Clay, do you yield?
I yield.
She does proceed.
Thank you, Senator. I think I understand your legislation. I think it's good legislation. But I thought I'd mention that a couple people ought to encourage me, said, you know, if the Senator is going to help filibuster a bill that you're passionate about on prescription drug, why don't you go ahead and just kill her? Because that's the way we send to do it in the Senate now.
Oh, that didn't sound like a gentleman that I know out in the hallways.
Oh, no, it sounded like one that's actually in this room. But...
Well, and that's just fine, because I got a lot of talking to do on some of those bills.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to kill this. I'm going to vote yes, Bart. But I just want to express the frustration on a bill that I'm passionate about that you voted for twice in past sessions to be filibustered on this floor. And I just thought I'd express that. I'm going to let this bill go and say yes on it because it's a good bill. And I just thought I'd tell you once again, we could be getting in a... just a hitting match, but I don't think that that's what the purpose of this body is. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Does any other senator desire to be heard? Seeing none, Senator, you're recognized to close.
I close.
The senator from Clay renews her motion that Senate Bill 911 be declared perfected and ordered to print it. As many are of the opinion that motion shall prevail, say aye.
Aye.
Those to the contrary, no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The bill is declared perfected and ordered printed. Staying on that same calendar, we are on Senate Bill 576, Senator from Saline.
Mr. President, I now move that Senate Bill 576 be brought before the body for perfection.
You've heard the motion from the Senator from Saline. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Senator, the bill is before the body.
Mr. President, I now move for the adoption of the Senate Committee substitute. This is the charter bill. The main thing that this bill does is bring accountability to charter schools on the same level as public schools. One of the biggest concerns I've heard down here since I've been here is that there wasn't enough accountability for charter schools, and we bring about accountability in a number of ways where we apply APR. We bring about accountability in a number of ways. We make the sponsor more accountable. We make the chartering entity more responsible, and I think that we bring the same level, the same APR points that apply to the charter school also apply to the public school, so we can get a feel for performance. It's been my concern that we don't need any more bad schools, and this helps to ensure that. The other part of the bill that I think is important is that we expand charters to allow any accredited school district to sponsor their own charter. So basically, we bring this down to local control, and we have local school boards deciding whether to charter their bill or whether they want to have a charter school or not. They are in control. They're elected by the local folks, and so it allows them to adapt the needs of their community and answer those needs with a charter. Mr. President, I think this is a bill that moves us forward. We have consensus, which is something very difficult to find in this arena, and we've done everything we can, I think, to try to answer most of the questions, and I think we've got a good bill here. I'll be glad to answer any questions. I move for the adoption of the committee substitute.
The senator from Saline has moved for the adoption of the Senate committee substitute, the Senate Bill 576. Does any senator desire to be heard? Senator from Johnson,
thank
what
you.
Purpose do you stand?
Speak on the bill.
Proceed.
Thank you very much. Senator from Saline, I think, has an excellent piece of legislation here dealing with charter schools. Obviously, charter schools currently are restricted to Kansas City and St. Louis, and so a lot of us from outstate Missouri might not have that much experience or much knowledge of charter schools. This would allow charter schools to expand outside of those two areas. However, it would be very limited. It would have to be with the approval of the local school boards to do that and then be operated by the local school board. So I think it's a very reasonable expansion of charter schools. I think the most important part about the legislation is that it add some needed requirements to it, that there's transparency, that there are ways that we can monitor our charter schools to make sure that they're doing the job that they say they're going to do. And we've had some fantastic charter schools that are just doing some amazing things, but we also have some that quite honestly are underperforming. And for those underperforming schools, we need to be able to monitor that and to keep an eye on them. And then in the unlikely event that some charter schools are not performing well, or there's something that's going on that might be illegal or something that would be detrimental to students, we need to be able to pull the plug immediately, and that's what this bill does as well. I would certainly encourage my colleagues to vote in favor of this. That's a good piece of legislation. I want to thank the senator from Saline for doing this, as well as last year, and it's a good piece of legislation. I would encourage my colleagues, let's try to keep this a clean bill dealing with charter school only, and let's try to get this bill moving forward. Thank you, Mr. President.
We are on the adoption of Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 576. Senator from the 14th.
Yes, I'd like to inquire of the Senator from Saline.
Senator from Saline, do you yield?
I yield.
He does. Proceed.
Thank you, Senator. Now, I think on Monday we were talking about this bill, and there are some questions and concerns that I had. Are they addressed in this bill?
Senator, I have an amendment that I'm going, that's just been distributed. I'm going to offer that amendment. I think that answers the questions that you had. At least that's what I've been told. And so if it's just now being distributed, I would have offered it already. But my intentions are to offer that amendment.
Okay. This, from what I'm looking at, this is only one part of what my concerns are. And I asked for my assistant to bring down my 50th law book because I have a couple of my notes that we had from the meeting in that book. And so hopefully they can hurry up and bring that down. But from my recollection, this amendment does not answer all of those things. And I do think that part of my issue had to do with school districts that are underperforming being responsible for charter schools. And I mean, that's kind of curious. If they're already underperforming in the regular public school, why in the world would they be responsible for a charter school? And they'll probably use the same practices, and those kids would be underperforming as well.
Senator, I think you would find that school boards in that position would not be running the charter schools. They could sponsor the charter, but the charter then would be run by someone else. And so,
but the sponsors do have a responsibility, isn't that right? From my understanding, sponsors have always been responsible to some degree for the schools that they sponsor.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I just had one of these notes and I
lost concentration.
Sponsors do have a responsibility.
Well, they have a responsibility to oversee, but they would not be in direct control of the charter.
So who would be in direct control of the charter? If the sponsor is not in direct control, who would be in direct control?
Charter. The operator.
Okay, so the operator
the sponsor,
is a third party.
The sponsor creates a contract or a charter with an operating, entity.
Okay, is it a private entity or a public entity?
That's up to the sponsor to.
So it could be a third party entity that's doing the day-to-day work of the charter school.
Yes.
Okay, so it could be like the old Edison. Or it could be.
It could be, yes.
Okay, so, and what do we have in place right now to make sure that those people who are doing the day-to-day work are actually doing what they need to do and the standards are held high? What's in place now?
I think it's very simple. What we do in the bill is create more transparency. We create more responsibility. We put more supervision, if you will, from the state school board to the sponsor, from the sponsor to the charter that runs the entity. And I think we cure a lot of the problems that we see in the process at this point.
Okay. Can you be more specific? I mean, just by saying accountability doesn't get us anywhere for me.
The accountability measures would be in the charter. And that's the way the sponsor and the charter, I mean, it's a contract, and that sets out the accountability measures. The state school board has more accountability measures with this bill than they do now with the sponsor. So they can yank a sponsor that is not performing.
Okay. So in your bill, does are charter schools extended to school districts that are provisionally accredited?
Yes.
Or just unaccredited?
I'm sorry.
Are charter schools allowed to open up only in unaccredited school districts or also provisionally accredited school districts under your bill?
They are allowed to operate in unaccredited school districts. Provisional school districts are allowed to create a charter sponsored by that school board.
Okay, so with this next amendment that you have, we're going to have to work on this. I'm not, I'm jumping from place to place, but this one that was just distributed, Indiana 01S, deals with three consecutive years. I do believe that another issue that I had is that we wouldn't be going backwards in terms of APR. Are we making a determination on whether we open up a charter school based on going from now forward or going backwards 3 years and then including whatever happens forward?
The way the bill reads right now is that we start in 2009, and so anything that's been provisionally credited for the last 3 years would be eligible to create, and that's where we are at this point.
Okay, so here's what I would want to do. I would want to go from 2012 forward. I would not want to go backwards, and that was part of the conversation that we had in my office.
Right, and I understand that, and I will not oppose that. What I will do is question it, because if you have students that are already in a provisionally accredited school, why would you want to put those students under 3 more years of that problem without giving them a breath of fresh air, if you will?
Well, because I also want school districts to know what they're going to do. I mean, if your provisional accreditation amendment passes, then, I mean, that is going to expand the number of charter schools around the state because it's going according to APR. And so I'm concerned about that because I'd rather start this year and move forward than go backwards so that school districts know, hey, listen, this is what you have to do. Either you come up to par or,
again,
you're going to have competition.
In the provisional accredited schools, only the school board can sponsor the charter. The charter can't open up their – I mean, they have to be the sponsor. It has to be a local decision by that local school board to create a charter in that provisionally accredited school.
And so how would that conflict with No Child Left Behind?
What's that now?
How would this, assuming all of this is adopted, how would that conflict with No Child Left Behind?
Senator, you're in an area that I'm not an expert in, so you'll have to tell me about that.
Well, I mean, okay, so that's not a good situation then because we're constantly dealing with AYP, No Child Left Behind, the provisions that are provided by federal government. There are certain things that school districts may do for individual schools, and I'm trying to figure out how this legislation, with the assumption that these two amendments are adopted, how that would conflict with No Child Left Behind. And I mean, that'd be critical for you to know that. Because there will be a competition. That's very critical for you to know that.
Okay, so can you tell me? I mean, what?
Well, here's the thing. For us to move forward on this bill, you should already have an understanding of that, number one. Number two, before we went to this bill, you and I should have had a conversation so that we can make sure that everything is in line so that we can move forward. So what I would ask of you is to lay this bill on the informal calendar so you and I can have a follow-up conversation, because I'm not going to move forward on this without your own edification of what the confliction is with No Child Left Behind and other things as well.
Senator, would you let me offer
I mean, you can offer it, but I'm going to stop at some point. I'm going to stop you at some
fine.
Point.
That's fine. And maybe.
But what we need to do, Senator, I mean, and I am very thankful that you et al. Came to my office on Monday to talk about this. It was a preliminary meeting, but there should have been a follow-up meeting, because these two amendments, which in part deal with our conversation that we had on Monday, they're not dealing with my issue in full. So okay. We need to settle those differences now before we move on.
All right. Senator, if you would allow me, I would like to do S1. It is not my intention to offer the second one.
The second one, okay, so why isn't it your intention not to offer this one? Because this was part of our conversation that we had on Monday.
We can have that conversation. I was under the impression that we'd had the conversation. I was told that this would take care of it.
No, I make the last call for my determinations. No one else does that. So what I am saying here is that we need to go offline so that we can talk about the full extent. And my assistants have still not brought down my book, The 50th Law, in my purse, and which has all my notes in it from our meeting. We need to go offline before these two are adopted.
Do you object to the first one?
What I'm saying is there are elements of the first that are not fully explored. There are elements of the second that we also need to explore. You and I need to get offline to have a conversation, because I do not want to move forward, and I will not move forward.
Okay, thank you, Senator. I guess we can ask the floor leader what he wants to do. Senator, you have the
Senator
floor.
Senator from the 14th, you have the floor.
Yes, I'd like to inquire of the Senator from the 23rd.
Senator from the 23rd. Would you yield to an inquiry from the Senator from the 14th?
Of course.
He yields. Proceed.
Purse. I don't want my purse. Thank you, Senator. Okay, so the Senator from Saline and I had a preliminary discussion on Monday in regards to some of my concerns in terms of this bill. He just indicated that you want to talk about this bill, and I don't know to what extent you wanted to talk about it, but it's my hope that the Senator from Saline and I have a conversation offline before we move forward, and I'm not comfortable moving ahead because there are certain elements of this bill that we did not finish in our conversation. We have not had our final conversation to what we agree on so we can move this bill forward. So I didn't know if this is something that you want to deal with right now.
I always support where senators can get together and in 10 minutes or half an hour save 4 hours on the Senate floor. I always want to encourage that type of discussion. So I've got other bills on the calendar. We were just working down the formal calendar. I'm working on one that we skipped over, and so, you know, if you guys want to do that and you're ready later on, then I'll bring it back up.
Okay, I would like to do that. Mr. President?
Senator from the 14th.
I'd like to inquire of the Senator from Saline.
Senator from Saline, do you yield?
Yes.
He does. Proceed.
Thank you. Thank you for the inquiry, Senator. So would you be amenable to us going to the side?
Absolutely.
And having a conversation so we can finalize what our agreement
Whatever
is?
My office. These?
Okay.
Mr. President, I'm sorry. You still have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator from Saline.
Would you please lay this on the informal calendar?
The bill shall be laid on the informal calendar. Staying on that same calendar, we're on Senate Bill 661, the Senator from the 15th. Senator from the 15th is in eyeshot.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that Senate Bill 661 be brought before the body.
You've heard the motion from the senator from the 15th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Senator from the 15th.
Thank you, Mr. President. I now move for the adoption of the Senate Committee substitute. For the benefit of the body, this is an idea in a bill that I filed last year. We struggle with, I think, a lot in state government as to how to have broad-based tax relief for every business. And, you know, last year what we did with the franchise tax was there was a threshold that had been stepped up over the years, and we've once and for all eliminated it so that no business would have to pay the corporate franchise tax, which was really a double tax on assets. If you talk about reducing the corporate income tax, you're really only dealing with companies that are organized as C-Corps. And so how do you get at this issue of all of the small business? What we talk about a lot on the campaign trail is how do you provide tax relief for the four-person accounting firm? How do you provide tax relief for the LLP? How do you provide tax relief for the closely held businesses? And this is an attempt to do that, which would say that over a five-year period, we would phase in up to a 25% business income deduction. What does that mean? If the senator from Phelps and I open a pizza shop in Kirkwood, okay, and we gross $200,000, after all of our expenses, we net $100,000, we would be able to deduct a certain percentage of our business income to reduce our tax liability. And that would apply to any corporation, however it's organized in the state. And it's really an attempt for the benefit of this body to move forward an idea. We talk a lot about reducing the tax burden on every business in the state, and this is what this bill is an attempt to do, and would be happy to answer any questions.
The senator from the 15th has moved for the adoption of Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 661. Does any senator desire to be heard? Senator from the 4th, for what purpose do you rise?
Bar the senator from the 15th.
Senator from the 15th, do you yield?
I do.
He does. Proceed.
Thank you, Senator. I'm just going through the summary here, but the fiscal note, I will tell you, caught my eye.
Yes.
I've sat here for, 10 weeks now, worried about the budget, and 3 years from now, we're going to cut another $200 million out of the budget?
That's if you assume no growth. Yeah. If you assume no growth, and I will tell you that those numbers are significantly different than last year's fiscal note. And if you look to the fiscal note the actual impact, and I went back and forth with Mickey about this, the actual impact based on revenue that's received, okay, on page 2, not the estimated fiscal impact, but on page 2, the fiscal analysis by DOR, goes from $21 million to $104 million over the five-year period. And that is a reflection of, after all of the current deductions that those businesses already get, that would be the actual impact to the state. And again, it's just a matter of philosophy. If you assume that businesses aren't going to hire people, if they're not going to invest, that's possible. I don't think that's likely. That's not the philosophy that I have. So.
No, and I understand your argument, obviously. There's a lot to be said that the consumer pays the corporate income tax rate. I understand that argument. I'm more concerned with what was the franchise savings?
It was phased in over a five-year period, and I think at the end of the phase-in, it was $87 million.
$87 million, yeah. Was that last year or the year before?
Last year.
Is that last year?
Yeah.
So,
and I think
this so now we're almost $300 million.
This is the senator from the 15th's idea of tax reform, I suppose. I think what's interesting is, in addition to some of the other things that have been done on the incentive side, I think that what happened last year by eliminating that double tax, I think you're seeing, and I've heard it from people, you're seeing those investments being made. The big manufacturers, especially Ford, GM, the franchise tax is a part of it. It's not the only thing. But I do think everything that we do makes Missouri more competitive. And I'm well aware of the budget. And I just think, look, we've been doing what we've been doing, and we're at where we're at. And
well,
I think.
But let me stop you there. You know, when we say make Missouri more competitive, and it all depends what survey you're looking at, but we're like, you know, that's one of the areas that we're not at the bottom.
That's correct.
We're like number 5 or number 6 someplace in there.
That's correct.
So how much better do we need to be? And in order to make that next step up, how much is it going to cost? How far is $200 million going to get us?
Well, again, I think, you know, revenues are at where we're at partially because of our tax policy. And it's my belief that by making it a more competitive tax policy, we will encourage not just growth from industries that don't, that aren't here, but when I honestly, and this sounds like I'm spinning a yarn and what people say, you know, but really, when I talk to business owners at a round table in West County or in Kirkwood, I mean, and I ask them, what is it? You know, well, you know what? If we weren't, regulations are clearly a part of that, the burdensome regulations, but also, and all the hoops they have to don't jump through, but if their cash flow was a little bit better, if they weren't paying the taxes there, they would be able to bring on that extra person. They'd be able to buy that extra machine. They'd be able to make that additional investment. And so that's sort of the what spurred my last year really looking at it. And this is an idea. And I know, you know, the senator from Cape, you know, and I admire him for this. I think you got to push forward ideas. Not, I know not everybody's going to agree that this is the way to move forward. But I think that this kind of broad-based tax relief is the direction we need to go and needs to be part of our portfolio. So that's why I've got the bill in front of us today.
Well, the obvious question is, I mean, I'll be the first one to ask this to you, but I would imagine there's probably five or six other guys in here that are going to ask the same question. What are we going to cut? What are we going to cut to fund it? Because, you know, I lived through, personally, I lived through the Reagan years. I'm not sure supply side works. Trickle down doesn't always work.
Yeah, well, I'm a Jack Kemp Republican. So that is he's the guy that I admire for a bunch of different reasons. I think he had a social conscience, but he also he believed that allowing people, business owners, individuals to control more of their own money was economic freedom, and that they could then go out and spend that the way they chose in the marketplace. And I think that this would allow us to put some of those dollars that people pay to us to redistribute into hosting that charity softball game, hiring that new employee, doing those sorts of things that people in our community want to be able to do, but we're dealing with a very difficult economic environment, and I think the more dollars people can have to spend in the economy is a good thing.
No, I guess we aren't going to agree on this,
right?
Because, you know, we have a lot of people coming through, and they come to your office too, I'm sure, what programs they want to save, how they're being hurt. I'm not sure it's appropriate time to be cutting out some revenue, and especially 3.25%, or even 6.25%. That's not overly burdensome.
I don't think it's. I think we can be more competitive. I wouldn't agree with that. But I'm saying I think if we did this, we would have one of the maybe the most competitive tax structure in the country. And I do believe that site selection people, and that's not the only thing they look at, but it is a big factor because it's ultimately what companies are and individuals are giving away. And the other reason that I really believe in this is because it isn't just limited to the big companies. You know, it's not just limited to C corporations. It is limited to the family, or it's not. It's extended to the family business, those entrepreneurs. However you're organized, because most of those companies, as you know, in your practice, it's flow through income.
Right.
You know, it they're taxed at their individual tax rate as those dollars make their way to their individual tax return, and we haven't really figured out a way to get those folks tax relief, and that's what this is an attempt to do.
All right, Senator. Thank you for the inquiry.
Thank you.
Senator from Cape, for what purpose do you rise?
To inquire the senator from the 15th.
Senator from the 15th, do you yield?
Yes, I do.
He does. Proceed.
Thank you for yielding, Senator. And I just want to roll through so I understand how this works. What is it? What tax relief are you providing, and what instance do we pay taxes on that we won't pay taxes on now? Because I see these new definitions of business income. I don't even know what business income is. I have an LLC. I'm taxed on personal rates.
Right.
It's all passed through.
Yep.
It's not called business income. So I don't even know what business income is.
Well, on the corporate side,
as you can see, it's reducing the corporate income tax rate by 25% over 5 years. On those other entities where you do have the...
Okay, so that's part of it, the corporate...
Yeah.
Okay, why should we give the corp... I want to cut my taxes. Well, the individual people out there all across Missouri that since 1993 when they passed Senate Bill 380, where I'm learning painfully now as filing as a married couple, the marriage penalty tax and all of that stuff, but I don't have your kids. And I got no write-offs. I mean, none. I got nothing. And I also thought I was doing the right thing where I have very low home debt, so I don't even get to write off the home interest loan. I got nothing. All I do is pay everything to the federal government. And one thing that I do know that's out there is the fact that when we passed Senate Bill 380, we eliminated the full deductibility on the state level of our federal taxes. I'd rather do that if we're going to talk about a $200 million fiscal note than corporations or coming up with business income, because I see where you said business income shall not include compensation. Well, that's what it is. I mean, I get a K-1 and that becomes compensation to me.
No, what it is that whatever your gross income is, okay, I mean, I don't know what it is, but let's just say you gross...
Not enough.
Well,
evidently.
I believe that. We're in the same boat. Let's say it's $500,000, okay? You bring in, because you're just a phenomenal lawyer, and your partners are all very good, and you bring in, you know, and it's divided among the partnership, however you split it up. It's $500,000. After all of the expenses are taken out, you have a net number. That's your that's your income. Now, you're taxed at whatever tax bracket you're in, you're taxed at that rate. And what this bill is doing in an attempt to, in my view, solve a problem that we haven't been able to solve before, which is how do you have that tax relief for the mom and pop, the small business? They don't get a benefit if we're just reducing the corporate income tax rate. They don't
see
that.
Wait a minute. I mean, maybe my structure's set up differently than how mom and pops, but I would say they've got a terrible accountant. Our partnership, as us as lawyers, is never, ever supposed to make money. If it's making money, we're not doing our distributions to ourselves at a proper rate because we're not paying the tax rate of my law firm's LLC, and then me as an individual have to pay that. So we never really show a profit.
But you,
and all of it is a pass-through
income. But you are receiving income.
Exactly.
Correct. Through the business that you are associated with, whether it's organized as an LLP.
No, me as an individual,
yes.
I am.
Yes.
Me as an individual, I am through pass-through taxation. That's why I'm saying I don't understand this whole business income deal and how that's going to help anybody that has LLCs and small businesses.
Well, whatever the gross income is, okay, I mean, at some point, you're paying yourself something through the entity by which you were organized from. And what this, in practical application, if that income is $100,000, okay, if you're fully phased in, you would get a 25% reduction on that. So then at that point, you're only being taxed at $75,000. Not the full $100,000. That's the deduction that you get on your individual income tax.
I don't know that works out that way, on the way that,
well,
that
I'm happy
we have
that, you
our,
know, I mean,
that we have it structured. I mean,
I'm happy
our LLC never makes money. And it's set up.
That's not a good commercial.
No, it is.
You
ought
to put that on
the
billboard.
And that's how most people do it.
Yeah.
That's how most people do it, because they have to have pass-through taxation,
yes,
that goes to them, so they pay on the personal rates, not the corporate rates.
Right.
All right? No one wants to pay the corporate rate, then do a K-1 distribution, and pay the personal rate.
Exactly. Correct.
You know? So I understand what you think you're doing here, but in practicality, the world doesn't operate that way.
Well, that's how it works whenever I pay my tax.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I guess what I do know is that I don't get the full deductibility of the federal taxes that I pay on the state level.
I support that.
So, yeah, so I guess, but it depends on how much we're going to end up spending, and like the senator from the 23rd, I guess we're just rolling through all of these bills. I'm not comfortable with perfecting and stopping amendments till I can run this by some accountants that I understand and get a better feel.
Sure.
Honestly and truly, Senator, I didn't think we were going to get to this bill today. I think a lot of us have been caught cold on what bills we were going to get to, what
right.
bills we didn't get to.
I know where you're getting, and I'm more than happy to lay this over and work with you, because here's the thing. I understand that this is a big step, and it's a different step than we've taken before. And so I don't want to catch anybody up. I want everybody to have, and that's what this place is supposed to be about. But I do think, in a broad context, I do think that we need to somehow get at the problem of allowing smaller businesses to benefit from broader tax relief.
And I agree, and give them full deductibility. We're paying state tax on the taxes that we paid to the federal government. It's a tax on a tax.
Right.
How do I not get to deduct fully the taxes that we pay to the federal government? That's crazy.
We can work on that, and I'm not going to comment on the dependent deduction you may or may not have down.
Yeah,
that's none of my business.
Yeah, exactly. But now, if you would be so inclined, I do want to go home over the weekend, be able to visit with my accountant. I'm in the process, as I've said many, many times here. My accountant and I have a relationship where we're done if I ever get a refund, because I hate giving the government an interest-free loan.
Well, you and I have similar weekend plans, because April 15th is coming up, and I'm making this.
Yeah, and I'm not one of these individuals. I find it, when I got married, we had interesting discussions, because we were talking about, how we do planning and how we do things, and when we merged our finances together and we looked at stuff, and I started explaining things, that you would never explain to your girlfriend, but you do find yourself explaining, and really didn't even explain to my then fiance, but now, kind of.
I have heard that there are some senators that didn't let their wife know there was a per diem, and that goes into a separate account.
Now that she's my wife, she knows everything. She knows that there's a per diem. She knows that there's a mileage check and all of that.
Good for
stuff.
You, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's crazy. I'm on a reverse allowance. I have like a $20 bill Monday morning when I end up leaving to drive up here that's sitting at the kitchen counter. That's my allowance for the week, and then everything else she controls. So, but anyway, we were talking about all of that, and my philosophy and what I shoulder is, we're not getting a refund come April 15th. In fact, some of these funds you think are our funds that are sitting in this checking account right here, they're going to go away, and they're going to go away in a big way.
I always thought, because when I became a partner in my firm, nothing's being withheld from my, I write a check.
Exactly.
I claim, and I believe, that if everybody, what we ought to do is make everybody pay all their taxes on November 1st, and the election day is not very far behind, I think most Americans would be Republicans.
Without question. The worst thing that the federal government conned the people into believing is that it was a good idea to do withholdings so that people don't ever see that money.
Get used to your take-home pay,
and that's all that you end up really seeing. But somebody like yourself and myself that do quarterly estimates, you do the true-up and on April 15th, and then you do the new quarterly estimate. So I'm getting ready to write a lot of checks for the true up. I've done all my quarterly estimates. You do the true up. And then on top of all of that, you're going to end up doing your new quarterly estimate. So not only are your taxes that you owe on September or for 2011 due on April 17th, I think it's this year, not 15th, but on the 17th, because I'm the last postmark day, send it snail mail, take as long as it got. I'm holding on to my money as long as I possibly can and give it. But what people don't realize is you'll pay your true up for 2011 taxes and owe the first quarterly estimates all on the same day. It's a big check, and that's what I was telling my wife, Casey. I was like, Casey, we have to keep all this money sitting here in the side. No, you can't go shopping. No, you can't go do all of that. That's not really our money.
We had a similar conversation. My wife, Steven, our son who's seven, he loves the water. So we take him, you know, he swim lessons at Rainbow, but he loves the water. So we're talking about doing a pool maybe in the backyard or something. It's expensive, you know. It's really expensive. And we're talking about, you know, well, what do we got? What do we got right now? And I was like, it doesn't. April 15th is coming. It doesn't really matter what's in the bank. It's what we got to pay and what's left in the bank.
Exactly.
So anyway,
it's after tax day.
Yeah.
I'm with you, Senator.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator from the 15th.
I would ask that this bill be laid on the informal calendar.
The bill shall be laid on the informal calendar. Staying on the same calendar, we are on Senate Bill 475. The senator from the 24th. I did call it. Senator from the 23rd.
Mr. President, can we place that bill on the informal calendar?
The bill shall be placed on the informal calendar. Senator from the 23rd.
Without objection, the Senate will go to the order of business. The Senate bills for perfection, the informal calendar. Senate bill 837.
Senate bills for perfection, informal calendar. Senate bill 837. Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that Senate Bill 837 be brought before the body.
You've heard the motion from the senator from the 23rd. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would move for the adoption of Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 837. Mr. President, this is a bill relating to Missouri's liquor franchise law. We've got a problem. It's a law that's been in place for decades, and what has happened is ruling by the Western District of Missouri has prompted a review of Missouri's liquor franchise law as a part of the Missouri General Franchise Law and its definitions. As I mentioned, it's operated as a part of Missouri General Franchise Law for more than 33 years. What I'm trying to do is basically, because of this court decision, it's really upended what had been in place for decades. And what I'm trying to do with this legislation, if we can get back to the status quo, to where we can look at our franchise law. I know we've got some of our brewers in Missouri, and namely Schlafly and Boulevard, to name a couple. We've got some of our wine companies. They would like to see some revisions to our franchise law, and that's something I think we need to have a day for. In this body, but we need to fix this problem first, and then I think we can go about creating exemptions, and I'm willing to work with those Missouri companies to do that. I know others are interested in that as well. But the first thing is to kind of fix the immediate problem we have in resolving this court case. And so, you know, I'll answer questions to the best of my ability, and I will renew my motion.
The senator from the 23rd has moved for the adoption of the Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 837. Does any senator desire to be heard? Senator from the 7th.
Thank you, Mr. President, to inquire of the senator from the 23rd.
Senator from the 23rd, do you yield?
I do.
He does. Proceed.
Thank you, Senator, and this is going to sound like a strange inquiry, but there were some wineries in the Capitol today and some that I've worked really closely with, very concerned about this bill, and I didn't get into detail with them, but it sounded like, I mean, one thing that was said was that once a distributor gets the product in their warehouse, they lose control of it or something like that, that they felt like they would sort of lose their control of their business. Now, I've been working some of this same thing for distributors on a bill that I have, so I'm familiar with that side of it. And so I really don't know what I'm asking you, except that there's some concern about it, and really heavy concern. And I, what is that? Maybe you can help me understand.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, they've got a problem with existing franchise law. And it's the way that...
They meaning the breweries, the wholesalers?
The wine wholesalers. Basically, okay. You've got a liquor distributor will carry their product in many on many occasions. This is just a kind of a handshake agreement.
Okay.
And, the wine company is not bound in any way. And my understanding is through this interpretation, they would have to formalize that agreement, and that in some way ties the hands of the wine distributor. And kind of what they're talking about now is creating an exemption for those wine companies. And I think there's a mixed bag here. When you the threat, if we don't pass this, is when you come with, let's say a national distributor buys major brands or glazers. You know, those national distributors have relationships with much, you know, with like an Ernest and Julio Gallo, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. What I think a major brands allows is for that small carrier to introduce their product to the market, and so I think that state-owned. Or not state-owned, excuse me, that state-based private company provides exposure as these wine companies build their brand. Now, once they start building their brand, then I think our franchise law, there are constraints, I guess, on how it's, and like I said, this is foreign to me.
Yeah, me too. This is a great inquiry.
Right. But at some point, it limits their ability to grow. And so that's where they want a conversation. They want to change Missouri law to where they like the part.
They
like the part where the state, you know, Missouri companies give exposure to Missouri wines. But as they continue to grow, then it inhibits that inhibits their ability. And so that's I think where we have the dilemma with the Boulevards, the Schlafly's, and some of the wine companies in Missouri. They're reaching a point in the size of the market where Missouri's franchise laws is hurting their ability to grow their companies.
So it seems like they'd be for this rather than against it.
Well, for the very small person, the person that's just getting started, who wants to get their wine on the shelf, you know, the glazers, the major brands, they help those companies do that. But as they get established, then I think that's where, because that company doesn't have a national presence, and I guess it's in some way limiting. And there perhaps is somebody who can better answer this question, but as they've explained it to me, that's the way I understand it.
Oh, okay. It looks like this is abrogating law, so there was a judicial decision that it's abrogating, right?
Right. It's that...
Brown or whatever it is. Do you know what the decision was?
I've got a copy of it here. I can...
Okay.
It's the Missouri Beverage Company versus Shelton Brothers.
You know who knows more about this? That maybe you would recommend I inquire of? Or...
You know, and I'm happy to lay it over if my explanation's not good enough, and I don't want to rush through this. I care about the small wine producers that we have in the state, and they're good small business people, and it's just basically my interest in trying to address this immediate concern that we have that could hurt
you know, the ability to keep these Missouri-based companies a going concern in Missouri, and then look at other legislation to address the problem that that the people you're talking to have with Missouri's franchise law, the way it is, or the way it was prior to this ruling. This wasn't their case.
Yeah.
And so they didn't, but now that it's been opened up, they want to revisit a part of Missouri franchise law that they're not real enamored with.
Okay. I guess I'm willing to sort of do what you want to do. I don't want to slow up your bill because I don't have the answer.
We still got a little bit of time to do this. We'll lay it over, and then you and I can visit with them
together,
and then
we can find out a little more. But because maybe
I'd like to give the body a better explanation than I'm giving them right now.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Mr. President, would you please place this bill on the informal calendar?
The bill should be placed back on the informal calendar. Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Without objection, the Senate will go to the order of business of announcements.
Announcements. Announcements. Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Without objection, the Senate will go to the order of business of reports of standing committees.
Reports of standing committees. Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics has a report.
Send the report forward. Madam Secretary, please read the report.
Mr. President, your Committee on Rules, Joint Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Bill 911, begs leave to report it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Also, Senate Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 842 begs leave to report it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Also, Senate Bill 813 begs leave to report it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Also, Senate Concurrent Resolution 20 begs leave to report that it is considered the same and recommends that the concurrent resolution do pass. Also, Mr. President, Senate Concurrent Resolution 25 begs leave to report that it is considered the same and recommends that the concurrent resolution do pass. Also, House Concurrent Resolution 37 begs leave to report that it is considered the same and recommends that the concurrent resolution do pass. Respectfully, Senator Dempsey, Chairman.
Senator from the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. President. No further business coming before the body. I move the Senate stand adjourned under the rules.
You've heard the motion from the Senator from the 23rd. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The Senate shall stand adjourned under the rules.